the impulse in the left and among progressives to unquestioningly support Kurdish activists uncritically, I think it's a similar impulse to how progressives, like many people who, you know, subscribed once to the Nation magazine or wrote for the Nation, once supported Israel. Israel was also a progressive cause, but we've forgotten that completely.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast.
Arturo DeSimone is a writer on politics and culture, and his work has appeared in Counterpunch, Compact, Open Democracy, and the Fortnightly Review, along with the DiEM25 News. From 2018 to 2021, he was a co-founding member of the Peace and International Policy, a subdivision of the Democracy in the European Movement, which concerned itself with the movement's critiques of EU foreign policy and security issues. And today we're going to discuss a statement on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by a group of individual members of DiEM25. Arturo, welcome to the Diet Soap podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'm very glad to have you on and to have seen your statement. It seems to me quite sensible. I thought maybe what we could do is start by walking through the bullet points on it.
Just to clarify, this statement is not recent. We drafted this, we wrote this during the previous flare-ups, the previous escalation of this conflict when the Israelis invaded Sheikh Jarrah. But I just thought that this program and the whole reaction around it might be an example of what happens often.
You mentioned that this was taken to be a controversial statement when it was drafted.
Yes.
Is that true? How did that fall out? I mean, what were the sides in the controversy around the statement to begin with? Why was it controversial?
Mostly it was controversial because it was seen as insufficiently radical. We quickly entered a competition with members of the leadership who seemed to want a more emotional statement. And you know, I'm not against emotion in politics. I'm not for simply cold, you know, rhetoric or cold analysis of things, but this conflict, what happens is usually the left and much of the world is very much dormant on this issue until there is a very important atrocity or the cluster of atrocities that come together usually at some point in the year, and then there are around the world, you know, many outpourings of a lot of sentimental imagery in solidarity with the Palestinians, or I guess Israelis, but there is seldom much of a program. And I think that with this conflict, anything that might sound like, you know, the words peace process, or if you say both, the word both, if you say the word conflict, if you call it, if you refer to it as a conflict, already that's, I think, generates a certain kind of disaffection or irritation in the left, because there is an understandable cynicism that has been generated around any terms of you know, a peace process of any kind. There's a lot of cynicism around the two-state solution because many Western politicians, U.S. politicians, have constantly, in a bloodless way, they've invoked the two-state solution, but they've never had the courage to enforce it. It's never been enforced. And so I think that because the two-state solution, which basically means, you know, that Israel retract to its internationally recognized borders and the illegal settlements, evacuate the illegal settlements, allow for the establishment of a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, and the occupation, which is the factory of atrocities in our contemporary moment, this occupation, which is like half a century old by now, since 1967. If you talk about ending the occupation, people will say you're a denialist, that you're ignoring what happened in 1948. You're trying to trivialize what Palestinians call the al-Nakba, the dispossession campaign that was waged by the activists who became the Israelis, the armed groups, so the Zionist groups who became what later Israelis. They waged a campaign of dispossession in 1948, and so if you talk about ending the occupation, you are told immediately that you are justifying 1948, or that you're allowing for that, and that you're asking the Palestinians to embrace Israel, to see legitimacy in Israel, and therefore, ergo, you're called a Zionist, liberal Zionist, apologist, or that somebody who's calling for what's called, you know, normalization. And normalization is also an often invoked dirty word, even though for many decades the Arab League position on the Israel-Palestine conflict, which was, you know, the diametric opposite of the Abraham Accords, it used the word normalization because it's...
How is their use of the word in opposition or diametrically opposed to how it's used in the Abraham Accords?
Well, because it names preconditions, the preconditions of the normalization of relations between Israel and the majority of Middle Eastern states. That means there has to be a just resolution for the Palestinian question, and an end to the occupation that began in 1967, end of the illegal settlements.
So the Abraham Accords were attempts at normalization without any attempt to address the occupation of Palestine.
Yeah. The Abraham Accords are, maybe they're a very vulgar, farcical repeat of what happened at the end between Jimmy Carter and Anwar Sadat and Israel, when it started out as something that was about resolving the crisis, the constant crisis of the Palestinians, but then the Palestinians were completely cut out of that, and it became more of a treaty between Egypt and Israel. But the Abraham Accords are, I think, more vulgar. I think the Abraham Accords do emerge more from Gulf states being a bit blasé. They've become tired of this conflict. They've grown more distant from the Palestinian issue. They want Israeli technology and software. And Netanyahu is extremely clever and manipulative. I think the Abraham Accords are a terrible thing. If it's very easy, my point, I'm maybe going a bit off point.
This is good.
Yeah, it's very easy to be accused of this thing, this nebulous thing called normalization. And the BDS movement, I think, made a mistake of justifying its own participation in cancel culture by saying we must prevent normalization. So the boycott, divestment, sanctions movements had a very long campaign of, for example, trying to get Israeli films or Israeli artists or Israeli academics banned from events in Europe or pulled. They like to use, cancel culture often uses the term pulled because you're not supposed to say this is censorship. And so it became quite commonplace to try to use deplatforming tactics against Israeli artists, Israeli academics, because, for example, the Argentine-Israeli conductor Daniel Barenboim, I'm not a huge fan of him, I'm not, but I find his initiatives valuable. He has an orchestra of Palestinian, Lebanese, and Israeli musicians who play together. And he was a good friend of Edward Said, and there was a whole activist campaign to boycott his performances by BDS to try to get him deplatformed, I think in Qatar, of all places, and in a few other places, and they accused him of normalization. They said he's a Zionist, he's trying to do normalization, and normalization means that, on the one hand, I understand there's a suspicion of getting sentimental, pretending it's a symmetrical conflict, pretending this conflict is just about the unwillingness of people to talk to each other or to be good neighbors. I understand that kind of cynicism. But I think that when it becomes, a Stalinist habit of deplatforming people, of shutting down conversations, people have also, in the BDS movement, they also protested against Noam Chomsky giving a lecture because they said he's for normalization. He is a Zionist. And they didn't bother to look up, what Chomsky means with Zionism. It's a very different thing, very different concept of what Zionism, what should have been, or what was supposed to be, right? Mm. So in any case,
were the people that were critical of this statement basically attempting to, or would they have preferred that it might have included a statement like from the river to the sea, like just retake Israel? That would they denying the right for Israel to exist?
Is, right,
that's another way to put it.
Well, that's a popular slogan. When I was younger, I would hear that at protests, when I'd go to these protests. And that's a slogan that's, when people say it, they're not really, sometimes they know what it means, but often they're not pausing to reflect what that is really proposing. And I think one should be aware of, if you are for Palestinian Arab nationalism and fine, but you have to be conscious of it. But I think that what happened in the movement was that figures like Varoufakis, Yannis Varoufakis, who's the leader of the movement, he at first had appointed us to develop a policy on the conflict. He didn't directly, we were working on this policy, on these ideas for years, but then the leadership indeed decided that they wanted a more radical than thou position, because I think mostly their intention, which backfired, they wanted to resolve an internal problem in the movement, which is that the movement had been somewhat hijacked by very, very politically correct type of activists from Germany. And so they wanted to scare these people off a bit, but also they are sincere in their idea, their intention of indeed declaring that there should be overnight a single secular state for the Palestinians and the Israelis. And their proposal is on the website. And they asked me for feedback initially on their idea. I told them that I found this is, it's radical chic, it's self-defeating, because, well, to answer your question shortly, yes, they were just calling for a very quick single state solution, with very little clarity as to how they really intend to enforce that, to achieve that. I think if you're going to do that, I frankly prefer Muammar Gaddafi's booklets on Isratain, not because I agree with him, but at least it's funny and it's, you know, it's earnest.
Well, what was, tell me a little bit about that. One second, I'm going to adjust my chair. My chair has started to sink down on me. I need to repair it, maybe. So, I mean, what was Gaddafi's vision of a single state solution? Or I don't know it, so tell me.
Well, I mentioned Muammar Gaddafi because I find him funny. I think it's, as far as the dictators in the Middle East go, I think it is a pity the way he had to end. But he was he had a utopian booklet about Isratain, and basically it was a little utopia he wrote about how people would live together in a new country named after both countries. And I came across it a long time ago, and I just found it quite funny.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, the difficulty for someone like me, who is not at all a scholar or an expert yes. on the conflict, is trying to navigate what is a sense, what are sensible. And, you know, I think what you've proposed here is sensible on its face, you know, like it is clearly attempting to speak in a realistic way to the political situation, as far as I understand it. I think that anyone who tries to propose an end to the conflict might be accused of being utopian. It seems to me, and again, I'm not an expert, that the conflict is emerging from a long history. It's kind of emerging from the fact that the attempt to create modernity or democracy or bourgeois society went off the rails, like in a massive way. It comes out of World War One and World War Two, and so it's like a remnant of all these failures to develop. It seems like we have a large task when you try it, because it's like this focal point of failure is Israel. But what do you think about that kind of grandiose or abstract statement?
If I understand correctly, I think I do disagree with it.
Okay.
I think it has to do with the way in which certain values or ideas of the nation state arrived a little bit later to the Middle Eastern region and were embraced by people who wanted these as well, despite not being Europeans or not being considered fully Europeans, as Jews were not considered that in Europe. So they had to leave Europe to those who wanted some form of nation state or some social experiment. And of course, Palestinian Arab nationalism has very similar origins. Nationalist ideas have been very popular among in the Middle East among former subjects of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, there was also a Palestinian bourgeoisie, and there are still vestiges of that. Their society was rather developed, and so there was 1948, that decade, of course, was a decade of many different kinds of ethnic cleansings, of attempts to erect states, like, for example, the whole, like, Pakistan was also emerged, I think, a year later. And it's a similar tragedy. You know, they want to make a state for oppressed Muslims who are oppressed in India, for many refugees. The partition of India resulted in 2 million deaths. I think that began in 1949. I'm not a historian. That date might be a bit off. So I'm not comparing this to trivialize, of course, what happened to the Palestinians. But I think that the occupation in itself is the simpler aspect of this. And so there is an enormous amount of efforts towards mystifying the Israel-Palestine conflict in order to generate the idea that we cannot, that the watching world cannot really solve it, that the watching world, the West, but also now Asia, is getting more involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict. There's a lot of energy poured into the attempt to mystify the conflict, to make it seem much more complex than it is. But I think for now,
I guess what I was trying to say was just that because the project of the nationalist project in Europe, was such a failure, and continues to fail, that it's not a surprise that the setting up a just and harmonious society in Israel and Palestine would continue to be an immense difficulty, because after all, the World War I and World War II came out of the failures of the European revolutions to try to create a just and harmonious society in Europe, and one that was going to be internationalist in character, really, and instead, you know, we've had one war after another.
Yes, I do agree. I do agree totally that we need to go beyond nation states narratives and rhetoric, because there is no major catastrophe today that can be solved by the nation state, whether it is the enormous refugee crisis, whether it is the environmental collapse, whether it is the global financial systems cancerous expansion. There's no problem really that we can solve with the nation state, which is why the left should not be so fixated upon this idea, I think, of a single secular state, which is really, it is really a way to embed, I think, the ideal of what is hoped for by the side that I also I'm often sympathetic to, which is Palestinians. They the Palestinian nationalists, Arab nationalist ideal, of course, is to say that it is all their lands, that it's from the river to the sea, and the left has largely adopted that. I am not sympathetic to that. I'm not sympathetic to to either Palestinian Arab nationalism, or if it's still, to any insistence on a very ethnocentric state of Israel. But the left has been mostly, the left has presented a long-term solution to the conflict without a short-term. And the long term is, this, the idol of, which is, I think, something that might be interesting to Palestinian exile, but I am not a Palestinian, so I cannot hope for, I cannot see any importance in that. There are many states in the region, in the Mediterranean, like, for example, a big debate we had in the N25, which has a very large amount of Greek participants and activists. I gave the example of Greece. I asked, why is there a cross, in the, a white cross in the Hellenic flag? This is the flag of a Balkan country. You had a large Muslim population, Turkish speaking. You had a large Jewish population. You had Bulgarians who spoke Bulgarian. How did Greece, this little country, become such a homogenous place? And of course, that was achieved by young Greek nationalist intellectuals who got rifles and who decided to carry out campaigns of terror, intimidation, and ethnic cleansing. And so that's how Greece became a Hellenic state. They didn't come from Mount Olympus, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I tried to explain this, I was just making a comparison between Greece and the Israelis. Because if you suggest to the Israelis, that they should take down their flag, you know, pack up their, you know, change their identity, and perhaps I'm skipping over, you know, why it is people might ask, why it is that I assume that a large part of the left wants this, you know. But anyway.
Well, let's mm-hmm. talk about that for a moment. And then we should talk about the statement here. What happened recently after the attack by Hamas was that when Sublation attempted to cover the conflict and think about it from the point of view of Marxism, mm-hmm. We were taken to be we were taken to be Zionists by some, mm-hmm. and there were around the same time that we were doing that, a Marxist publication, American Marxist publication called Cosmonaut, mm-hmm. Published a statement declaring Hamas to be the material force that could represent the Palestinian interests or that would be mm-hmm. working to end the occupation, mm-hmm. and that calling anyone who would criticize or oppose Hamas as a political project, traitors and snitches and Zionists, mm. and something along those lines. I mean, I'm not remembering it word for word, but insisting upon an embrace of Hamas as the only path forward for those who wanted to see Palestinian liberation and decolonization. So that was what I was responding to.
Yes.
Was saying, you know, actually, no, I don't believe Hamas is embracing Hamas as the path forward. And then I would be accused of picking, you know, representatives of the left who didn't represent the left, that was not a common perspective on the left, and that I was, you know, basically strawmanning my opponents. So I'm guessing you're feeling like maybe people accuse you of something similar. Is that right?
No, I don't feel particularly accused or persecuted of anything. I just find that it is very difficult to have certain conversations towards establishing a serious political program for ending this conflict. I don't believe that Hamas can. I don't even believe that Hamas believes it can achieve all that much. I think that what they did achieve was to remind, to dispel an illusion. If they achieved something, it was to dispel an illusion that the Israelis had developed, that the Israelis had acquired in time, which is that with technology like Iron Dome or the wall, which is a wall that is also more or less, it's a technocratic fix. It's a machine, the wall. It's not just a wall. It's, you know, Iron Dome and other technology that the Israeli military uses, they had the illusion that they could have placid Western suburbia next to the situation in Gaza, right? And that illusion is gone. And also
the idea that there could be normalization between the Islamic world and Israel without addressing the conflict and the occupation of Palestine.
Right.
Was also
Netanyahu's impulse is to resolve them the worst possible way, which is he wants to send these people somewhere, but there's nowhere to send them.
He wants them to all turn into, I guess, refugees in Egypt. Is that the idea at the moment? That the population of Gaza will largely just end up fleeing into Egypt? Is that what is proposing at the moment?
I mean, I wouldn't put past Sisi to accommodate some crazy idea like that. I wonder where these people of Cosmonaut magazine, for example, where are they, or where are these European leftists are when the Sisi regime, right, was sending secret police to kidnap young people in the middle of the night, to take them to some dungeon, to be tortured, because the junta, the military regime in Egypt is truly awful. It resembles what we had in Argentina in the 1970s. And I often wonder, since the European Union is sending, I don't know how many billion euros exactly, I don't remember, I think 3 billion a year to the Sisi regime so he can clobber refugees in the Mediterranean. I wonder, where is the solidarity effort to prevent European support of a regime like that, which is clearly, if you're a young person is a Marxist in Egypt or expressing some Marxist type idea, even a young Italian boy was mistaken for an Egyptian student. He was disappeared by the Sisi regime, and the European Union barely addressed the issue because there's no pressure to do so, really. But when it comes to whenever there's the annual slaughter in Gaza, suddenly the left produces a lot of sentimental imagery, denounces the Israelis in very vituperative language. And I think that there is no effort on the left to understand how Israeli society functions. Is there a working class in Israel? Why is the working class so conformist? Why is it that Israelis for decades were willing to fight and maybe die for the state? Not that those values still exist. The Israeli army today is very modernized. And so it had become the Israeli occupation. There was an illusion that running the occupation would be like something like civil engineering or like, piloting a drone or something. So indeed, that idea that technology could have resolved the Palestinian crisis, that idea has been dispelled by the Hamas attack. And I think the Hamas attack was very gruesome. And I think that it's clear also, particularly the hang gliding man who was attacking, I think, the part of the Israeli population that is most despised by the Netanyahu electorate. And I think that there's every reason to suspect that given that Hamas, which was sanctioned under some kind of blockade, imposed by the White House, some kind of Hamas, which was under international sanctions, became very much dependent on Qatar, on cash infusions from the Qataris. Since the Qataris have a reputation for having been patrons of the ISIS ideology, the ISIS way of operating and thinking. The aesthetics of ISIS also, like Hamas's new video productions, are very much unlike what Hamas used to do. And the attack by the hang gliding man on the on the dance party, it seemed more, it was more reminiscent of the ISIS attacks in, a few years ago, which everyone has forgotten by now, that has been erased from our collective memory, that Islamic State. But I think that the influence of Qatar in the region, and particularly in Gaza, has perhaps come with an attempt to spread this ideology. And I think that the cosmonaut people were not paying attention when, for example, a very important leftist leader who was making the left relevant again in an Arab country like Tunisia, Chokri Belaid, a left-wing lawyer who had also defended freedom of expression when there was a rise of many Islamist judges to power after the Tunisian revolution, he was shot in the head by a Salafist. So that is the real position of Salafists, of Islamists, and of Hamas towards the left. But I think that we have to treat the right wing in the Middle East in the same way that you treat the Trump phenomenon or the far right phenomenon in the United States and in Europe. You have to examine why it is that the left has failed to create a hegemony, why it is that these fascist movements are very popular, why do we see a global rise of fascism? And we have to not see Islamism as very different from that. The reason why the far right...
No, it's clearly not. I mean, yeah. It's clearly not very different from that in my mind. I mean, it's more extreme than Trumpists, but...
Of course. But the reality is more extreme. The reality is such. And
Go ahead. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, just as you reject Hillary Clinton's explanation about the rise of Trump, we have to reject, the Israeli explanation or the Biden administration's explanation as to the reason for Islamism. Islamists, they provide, they're popular in the Middle East because they are the sole providers of social services often, especially because the old Arab secular regimes, these were welfare states, which was part of the reason why they had so much complicity. And they've been mostly destroyed, especially during the Obama era. And so the Islamists, their popularity is not because so many people are religious fanatics. I mean, that doesn't mean there are no religious fanatics and that the struggle with religion is not a problem in the region. It is. But mostly we have to have a material observation of this. They provide social services in societies that have been devastated, whether by neoliberalism or in the case of Gaza. I don't think you can say it's a neoliberal economy because it has no economy, but they're providing some kind of amenities for the people, and that makes them very, very popular. They do politics, and the left in the Arab world no longer has supports from the Soviet Union, and it began to be seen as a mostly middle class phenomenon, the left, but it exists, of course, and it is often a target of resentment from Islamists directed at the left.
There's an old Union song that goes, "There'll be pie in the sky when you die," and I think that is a sentiment that people are willing and even compelled to embrace when they don't see any path towards making the life that they're leading on Earth their own. When they don't have a way to direct, the world and participate in history, then the alternative is to believe in something that would redeem your life after it's over, to have a religious vision like that. And so,
of course,
pie in the sky when you die is a rational approach when the world is as as irrational and alienated as it is. So you have this statement from DM25. It starts by saying that ending the occupation remains our first long overdue priority. And
let me clarify then, that was something that I co-authored in a competition.
Right, 11 people signed it, right?
And we were in a campaign, but we did get some important support, but we lost the campaign against the Varoufakis position, which was, I described it earlier. And so it was a very strange process, many surprises along the way. And but anyway.
Okay. So yeah, that's something else that people are telling me I need to do is listen to Varoufakis. I like him as a personality, but I haven't found him to be particularly aligned with my politics ever since, you know, the crisis in Greece and the failure of Syriza. Yes. I would say that Varoufakis is my problem with him is not that he's too radical, but that he constantly seems to be able to overlook problems or contradictions in his own politics for the sake of political rhetoric. So like his understanding of the Greek depression, you know, he was going to try to solve that through basically sovereign currency in Greece, and he wanted to break off from the EU. And while, you know, that had popular support, I don't believe that it would have solved the economic crisis that Greece was facing. It was, you know, that it would have been that. So he didn't look deeper, would be my problem with Varoufakis overall.
I think he has some very good political economic ideas and analyses, but he doesn't have any understanding of strategy or how to implement them. And so he indeed fills the emptiness with public speaking. Indeed.
Okay. Well, you and I, my feeling is that as someone who has almost no practical ability at all to realize my vision.
But you're not running for prime minister.
That's right. Yeah, right. Yeah, I write science fiction novels and run a podcast.
That's important.
Yeah. So I criticized him as a Marxist. You know, he was too much of a, you know, welfare
state. Neo-Keynesian.
Yeah. Okay. And that's what that was my objection to him, you know, a decade ago. So to me, it's not very surprising that he would take on a radical chic position, given his inability to, as a political critic of capital and capitalism, to actually hew to the really difficult critique of Marx, which goes to the root of society and which would require an effort that, you know, would not be immediate in order to solve the problems. But let's go into, so this was the alternative to the supposedly more radical Yanis Varoufakis approach to the problem in Gaza and in the West Bank and in Israel. But you start by saying that the occupation ending has to be the priority. And in order to end the conflict, that has to be the first step. And then you go through and you have, what is it, 7 points? In a way, these 7 points are describing the strategy for ending the occupation, right? I mean, you start with the EU no longer supplying arms to Israel. That would be a way to help end the occupation. Go ahead.
At the time, I was very coldly realistic. So I noticed that most of the members of the N25 are these very middle-class progressives from Western Europe, which is slightly disappointing. I was hoping to meet more East Europeans in the movement, for example. So I thought how to meet these people where they are and make them understand why they should be interested in the conflict. Not because it's only interesting for them. It's, of course, interesting for people of all different social backgrounds to see an end to this conflict, unless you are a military defense contractor. But I wanted to specifically make it clear to them why it should be interesting to them. And, of course, Western European non-Marxists, they care about the rule of law. And at the time, there was a contradiction in French and German foreign policy, which I think today is no longer such an issue because of Ukraine. But at the time, there were clear laws against Germany supplying weapons to a country while it is embroiled in a conflict. So Germany would violate its own laws to send weapons to help prop up this conflict in between the Israelis and Palestine. Mm. And when confronted about this, Ursula von der Leyen simply said, "We make an exception because Germany has a special relationship with Israel." Right. And so this was very self-contradictory. Of course, in recent years, all of these countries are sending weapons. Even Chile is sending weapons. Everyone's sending weapons to Ukraine, which is embroiled in a conflict, and they're not sending diplomatic aid. So maybe that particular point today seems anachronistic. I was thinking of the audience for this program at the time. Mm-hmm. I think it's, of course, the EU is Israel's major trade partner, and so Europe is very important and very influential in the region. But Europe, since the late 1990s, has gone along with American foreign policy and American security interests. And that's why this has been the worst period for Palestinians, because the Europeans, even though they could often be hypocritical, they had a better position, a more complex position on this conflict. And Europe has become much more subordinate to the White House in recent years. So part of the idea of the whole foreign policy group in the movement was to get people in Europe to talk more about European interests as separate from those of North America when it comes to NATO, when it comes to the various, the Syrian war, when it comes to Israel-Palestine. The European Union invests in rebuilding the damage done after the annual or biannual major Israeli invasion operation in Gaza. The Europeans then pour a lot of money into NGOs, into the United Nations, and Europe also has many trade relations with Israel. Germany had an agreement with submarines. So we felt it was important to initiate a conversation about that and to foment a conversation about that in Europe as an important step towards ending the enablement. This conflict exists because there's so much support for this conflict. The Israelis have no reason to stop the occupation if they believe that this occupation is the keystone to getting all this American support. And by now, for many Israelis, it's hard to imagine what life would be like if one actually had to, you know, to interact with one's neighbors and to not depend on U.S. endorsement of Israel, which is an endorsement of Israel because of this conflict. I think the United States might even have to, you know, make it clear to the well, I'll leave that thought unfinished. Never mind.
Okay. So, but let me ask you this: why is it, do you think, that the United States has such a unwavering commitment to supporting Israel? And to propping up is the occupation in the way that they have done historically.
It has to do with interests that have become a bit anachronistic. I think that there are many...
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.